Cedar Island, Virginia was going to be the next Nantucket or Hilton Head, or so its owners believed 50 years ago, and again 25 years ago when they started selling seaside house lots there. But the last resort house on Cedar Island, an Eastern Shore barrier island near the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, is gone. It has slipped into the sea. Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal joins us to tell the story of Cedar Island and what its disappearance tells scientists about sea level rise in the mid-Atlantic. Also on the agenda for this hour, the future for open space preservation in Maryland and a look at issues before the General Assembly as Maryland's new Republican governor takes office with promises to roll back some environmental regulations. Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. It's our monthly visit with Rona Cabell, reporter with the Chesapeake Bay Journal and contributor to Midday, Midday on the Bay. Nice to see you again, Rona.
Nice to see you, too. Thank you.
This is a really interesting story that you have to start us off today. Cedar Island, Virginia. We're going to talk about this barrier island. Just so you know, folks, later in the show, we'll be talking also about environmental issues and the Maryland General Assembly, which convened starting yesterday for 90 days. And we'll be talking about that, what issues Rona sees on the horizon for the General Assembly. Also about program open space here in Maryland. But we're going to start off telling you about Cedar Island, Virginia, a barrier island. I had to look on the map to see where it is, Rona. It's way down there. It's down near the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, near Wachaprag, Virginia, a place where I went flounder fishing a couple of times with an uncle of mine. But tell folks about Cedar Island, what was and what is today.
This is a really interesting story that I stumbled on this summer when we were doing our sea level rise package. So there's a chain of barrier islands that starts at Assateague Island and goes all the way down. There's a Hog Island and a Paramore Island, and Cedar Island is kind of in the middle of this chain. And it's a long, skinny barrier island, which means that it's got an ocean on one side and an inlet bay on the other. And in the 1950s, there was a plan to build a big resort on this island, and they were going to call it Ocean City, Virginia. And they had envisioned plans to put a bridge from Wachaprag to this island. But there was a big storm in 1962, the Ash Wednesday storm, and it washed over the island, and Virginia planners wisely said, okay, no bridge. So 30 years later, plans reemerged. The developer, Richard Hall, his granddaughter inherited the island, and her husband was a developer, and they came back with plans for a more exclusive island because you could now only get there by boat.
This is in the 1990s.
This is in the 80s, yeah.
The late 80s. Okay.
In the 80s. And Virginia state planners and environmentalists thought this was a crazy idea because unlike other islands like Smith and Tangier, which are in jeopardy from erosion, barrier islands simply vanish. So they gain and lose sand in storms. They follow the ocean currents. They are not stable landmasses on which we should put structures. And cedar is even more vulnerable than most because it's so skinny and so long. But the developer said, well, I have a solution. I'll just sell long and skinny lots so that if the if the sea comes up, you just move your house back. And people lined up for these lots because they were very affordable. And within 20 years, all of the homes on the ocean side of the island were in the water.
You can see some amazing photographs of Cedar Island over the years. Recently, Rona posted on ChesapeakeBayJournal.com the story about the last house on Cedar Island vanishing, or actually being burned down by its owners because they knew the sea was going to take it. But before we get to that story, a little bit more on barrier islands. Ocean City, Maryland, barrier island. Assateague. Right. There was a plan, you reported, back in the 50s or early 60s to actually develop lots of housing on Assateague.
Right. And so the plan was to build 4,000 houses on Assateague. And that same storm that derailed the original Cedar Island plan for Ocean City, Virginia, put half of those lots underwater. And so at that time, the federal government basically decided we cannot allow this to happen. And so Lyndon Johnson authorized the National Park Service to buy out the owners of these lots. And I heard yesterday from someone who does work in this area that the National Park Service and the Corps of Engineers, they continue to manage the lots that they don't. There are a couple pieces of property that that have been submerged, but then they reemerge with sand, and they continue to monitor it because they don't want some property owner to come and say, "Hey, we technically own that, and we can build a house," because people have tried that over the years. The island is the main of the island is owned by the National Park Service, and it would be pretty hard to build something. But there have been court cases on less, so they have to continue to make sure that nobody builds there.
There was once a plan to develop 4,000 lots on Assateague, but you say that that plan went away. Of course, Lyndon Johnson stepped in, but after the same storm that you mentioned that affected plans for Cedar Island.
Right, right. And interestingly, even though that plan derailed plans for Assateague, the storm did, Ocean City did not seem to be deterred by the Ash Wednesday storm of 1962, and not only continues to build in Ocean City, but they also are building in West Ocean City, which uses Assateague to protect it. So we're still spending a lot of federal money to protect the west part of Ocean City from storms.
To replenish the beaches.
Yes, exactly. To replenish the beaches and to protect the investments that people have made. So
if you want to see those photographs, you can go to ChesapeakeBayJournal.com. We posted some on Facebook today. My Facebook page has photographs of Cedar Island from, I think, the late 1990s, in the 2000s, and more recently, the last few houses on there, and then the last house. Let's just tell folks the story of the last house, which disappeared in November, right?
Right. So Ben Benson, who was the developer who put the houses on the ocean side, those all went in within 2 decades. But there was a bayside of the island, and those houses were family places, and they were put on in the late 60s and early 70s. And these were people whose family had owned part of the island, and they put very modest fishing cabin type of structures on these islands. And going there for the weekend was kind of like indoor camping. And those structures lasted a lot longer. So the last one of those on Black Friday, right after Thanksgiving, the family who owned it went over to Cedar Island and burned it down. And the reason they did that is because a lot of the other owners of Cedar Island basically abandoned their property or let insurance pick it up. And so what happened is you have septic tanks and drywall and curtains and kitchen appliances floating in the Chesapeake, not the Chesapeake, in the Atlantic Ocean. And so these people wanted to be responsible. They had enjoyed the property and they had a strong conservation ethos. And so they burned it down.
Is there any reason to believe that sea level rise has something to do with this, or is this just the natural course of things as far as a barrier island goes?
Sea level rise is certainly speeding up the process of the barrier island erosion, and what's happening from the oceanographers that I talk to is these islands always moved, but they would lose sand and then they would gain sand. And what's happening now is because of the warming of the ocean, they're losing the sand, but they're not picking it up on the other end.
So the barrier islands would change shape over time. They would,
right.
One side would grow, another side would lose
exactly.
Sand. Someone even told me today about grandparents who owned a house on an island somewhere, I think he said North Carolina, where the owner on one side of the island actually gained some acres because of the growth of the island during his time. I think he had to go to court to prove that he owned the growth.
Right,
he owned
right.
The part that grew,
yes.
And where others had actually lost their houses on the south side of the island.
So right, right.
So one of the lessons here, I guess, or at least a subject for us to talk about, gets us into the next subject, which is open space. And the idea of, should you build or not build? Should you leave places alone? Should government have anything to do, any say over that? In Virginia, these commissioners who allowed the construction of some houses at Cedar Island against the advice of their own advisors, right? They must have felt, well, this is a property rights issue. If you want to build a house there, why should we stop you?
Well, it is some of that too. And remember, this is a big issue for local governments because there's major tax dollars, property taxes on oceanfront houses. Of course, it doesn't nearly pay for the services. Once these people got their houses approved, they came back to the Virginia Marine Resources Commission and started demanding piers and roads and, you know, things to help them get to their houses. Because mm-hmm. when you live on a barrier island and there's no bridge, you know, when the surf comes up, you need a way to get in. And so they continued to come and ask for things. And there was a point at which the election turned over and a new commissioner got on and he said, "We have unleashed a monster on Cedar Island and we need to pull it back." But that was not a popular sentiment at the time.
It's amazing to me how little time, relatively speaking, went by between the construction of those homes and the last one going away.
Oh, yeah.
But it's, 20 years, right?
It's amazing.
About 20 years on that. We get to Black Friday, you mentioned, in November. Of course, we have money constantly going into barrier islands. Ocean City, we mentioned that for beach replenishment. Galveston, Texas is a barrier island. And these things cost money to maintain.
Yes, they do. And I think there is a debate, a conversation that for a long time we didn't want to have, that we are finally having about places that we should abandon. And I think it's pretty clear we're not going to abandon Atlantic City and Ocean City and Galveston. But should we be putting money into places like I just wrote a story about the Bolivar Peninsula in Texas, which is a long, skinny peninsula with about 2,000 residents? It was absolutely flattened in Hurricane Ike, and it's being rebuilt bigger, grander, better. And I think there is a question to be asked about the rebuilding of these places, because it isn't just about the people who are moving back. They may be paying to rebuild their homes, but you and I and everybody else are paying to rebuild the beach. We're paying to rebuild the road. We're paying to put in the infrastructure that allows them to live on the coast. Even if you and I decide we're not going to accept that risk, we're subsidizing their risk.
Through the Army Corps of Engineers, right?
Yes, and other
What did you call it, by the way, the Bolivar?
It's called Bolivar.
Bolivar Peninsula.
It's named for Simon Bolivar. But it's pronounced Bolivar.
Have they taken any precautions? Are they doing anything to protect it, or are they just building?
Oh, yes. I mean, when I was there after Ike, it was a lot of old fishing cabins type of things, and a lot of those people haven't been able to afford to return. So houses are being built 15 feet up on these platforms, and they're being built a lot nicer than they were before. There are a couple million-dollar homes on this peninsula where there wasn't anything like that before. And people are deciding to take on double lots, some of them, so they have more space, so they have a bigger property. And they're rebuilding the beach and they're putting in dunes. And it is going to be a more fortified place than it was before. But you can't change nature. And the oceans are still going to move and the islands are still going to migrate. And so there's a question of how much fortification do you put up in a place like that? And they're talking about a $3 billion dike to protect Bolivar and Galveston. But how much of that do you do, and how much time does it buy you?
Hey, Rona, one thing I want to go over before we leave this subject and move on to open space, which is related. The other islands that we talked about before when we were discussing sea level rise a couple of times with you, Holland, Sharps, I think is another one, Barron Island.
Yes.
And then, of course, Smith and Tangier. They're all sinking to some degree, right?
Yes, they're sinking and there's erosion.
It's a different phenomenon than what we see with the barrier island.
Right. It's a different phenomenon. And something interesting, Dan, that somebody brought up to me the other day was that, you know, in the 1930s, there was a settlement on a barrier island called Hog. And when it started to become untenable, the people took their houses and they moved them across the bay to a couple towns in Virginia and they left. And no one thought to ask the government to come and rebuild their beach and put in a jetty or a dike or anything like that. They just left. And that's,
you mean they left the island that was going away?
They left the island
that
was going
away. They moved their houses.
They moved their houses,
yeah, right.
as they did on Holland, okay. and as they did on some of the other islands you mentioned. And that's what people did. When it was clear that those islands weren't sustainable anymore, people left.
But you can't do that with condominiums.
You can't do that with
right.
condominiums.
You can't do it with high-rises and tiki bars, you know?
Nope.
Oh, maybe tiki bars. Anyway, Rona Cabell is with us again from the Chesapeake Bay Journal. This is our January edition of Midday on the Bay. If you'd like to join our conversation... as we leave the subject of Cedar Island, but we can talk about it again if you want to make a comment about it, if you haven't visited there, or if you have a comment to make about barrier islands in general. 410-662-8780. In the next segment of Midday in the Bay, why can't we have more green space in the suburbs? Dan Roderick's here with Rona Cabell. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Dan Roderick's here, Midday on the Bay, as we look at issues related to the Chesapeake region with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. By the way, we do this show in collaboration with the Bay Journal, and we suggest each time go to their website. It's a rich website full of interesting stories and some great photographs. And you can get home delivery of the Chesapeake Bay Journal for free just by asking for it. Right, Rona?
That's right.
Go to ChesapeakeBayJournal.com and sign up for a subscription. But by the way, on Cedar Island, you mentioned the last house that the family that owned it decided to burn on Black Friday, and that was the end of it. That's the end of houses on Cedar Island. Did you get a chance to talk to anyone who owned property there, owned a house there?
Yes. There's a guy named Marcus Kilman, who the Nature Conservancy owns the island now. And Marcus works for the Nature Conservancy, and one of his jobs is to take people back and forth to the island. His father inherited land, and his family built a house on Cedar, and it was the second or third last house to go. And I spoke to him, and basically he was very philosophical about it. They knew going in that the island wasn't long for the world, because they had experienced the storms before, and they just really enjoyed the time they had there, and they live there or vacation there like it was indoor camping. I mean, they
right. reused. These weren't McMansions then.
These were not. They were.
Some of them in the photographs, some of them look pretty good. They're up on poles, up on stilts.
Yeah, those are the Oceanside ones. Those are the Ben Benson, the ones that the developer built. The one that Marcus Kilman and the red cabin that they burned
was on the Bayside.
They were much more modest. And I got this email from a guy who had read my story, and he said, Miss Cobell, I have a house on Cedar Island. I want to know if it's still there.
he didn't know?
And it turned out that we say in the story that the red fishing cabin is the last house. There is a very, very small, tiny wood shingled cottage. It almost looks like a shed. Next to a Coast Guard station, and that's his house. And so I got a picture of it, and I emailed it to him. I said, your house is still there.
Oh, so there actually is one house left.
And I took the opportunity to try to get an invite to come over sometime.
Oh.
And he said that it's his uncle's place, and he's not there very much.
Excuse me, did you have to do a correction?
No, because...
Did you know about the little shack?
I did.
You thought it was a shack.
But he's a very nice guy, and I don't want to downgrade his house. But I made it clear.
You already have, excuse me.
Sorry. I made it clear in the story that I wrote that there was one more house.
Wow. Property values on Cedar Island will never be the same once Rona Cabell is done with this. Thank you, Rona.
I'm sorry.
But it's all right. This is funny. Why can't we have more green space in the suburbs? This is a question you pose here as we take a look at open space in Maryland.
Yes, this is a question that I encounter in my everyday life because I live in the suburbs, and where I live, there really isn't much green space. And one of the few green spaces that we have, I live in Towson, is Towson Park. And you remember last year there was quite a controversy when Kevin Kamenetz tried to take that away and put in a fire station, and the people who use that park came and said, this is our only park, please don't take it away. So now the fire station is much closer to my house, but I'm still glad because I think we shouldn't be taking away community parks. And so the problem we have here is Maryland has really rested on its laurels, I think, in terms of, you know, we're the smart growth state, we're the state that's done it right. And sometimes we don't think as creatively as we could about how to get green space in other ways than Maryland Program Open Space, which is the government-funded open space program that allows states and counties to buy property. But the fund doesn't have enough money for everybody, and it has different priorities than the local government.
What are the priorities of Program Open Space currently?
So Program Open Space is focused on, well, there's two parts of it. There's the local side, which is focused more on the smaller parks and partnering with counties. Yes, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But the other part, the part with the larger chunk of change, so to speak, is focused on large, contiguous, big pieces of habitat on the water with high ecological value. You remember we talked about the Jesuit acquisition that O'Malley did early in his time.
Some Jesuit land in Charles County?
Southern Maryland.
Southern Maryland.
Large, mm-hmm. large pieces of property, very expensive. And so when you do that, I think that's a good thing to do. But then when you do that, you don't have money for the smaller pieces. Rock State Park in Harford County is another example. They had an opportunity to buy a very large piece of property along Deer Creek, and they took it. So
where do the funds come from for Program Open Space? Because that's part of this.
Yes, they come from the transfer tax. So when you buy a house or sell a house, 0.5% of the transfer tax goes to Program Open Space. So when it was designed for a situation when there was a lot of development pressure and a lot of houses changing hands, there'd be some hedge against that with open space. And when there wasn't much of that, the open space fund would be depleted. The problem with that is that pretty much every governor in the last 12 years has decided to take open space money for other reasons.
Oh, I can go back further than that, Anya. 1985-86, savings and loan crisis in Maryland. I'm pretty sure the governor and the legislature took a lot of money out of Program Open Space to help deal with that crisis.
Right. Yeah. So it goes, I guess, predates one.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So the problem is that O'Malley at least put the money back in, but he put it back in bond funds, which are less flexible. And one of the attractions to property sellers with open space is that the state has the cash to buy the property. If you sell it to a developer, what often happens is they buy it under option. A developer has to get subdivisions approved and permits and all kinds of things and stormwater. And so you might get a deposit, but you're not going to get the full $10 million or whatever it is right away. And so that's why sometimes people will take less money to sell to the state because they can get it right away. And you need to have those opportunities be available to you. You need to have the cash, because once those opportunities go away, they don't come back.
Well, how do you think Maryland has done overall with Program Open Space in acquiring open land, large tracts? Your concern, I understand, is the smaller pieces. Like if you live in an immediate suburb to Baltimore, one of the oldest suburbs like Towson or Catonsville, a place like that, you're not seeing enough of it. But it is out there. How do you think the state has done? I asked the question because a year ago, 2 years ago, a reader of my column wrote in saying, don't we have enough open space already? Why do you keep saying we need to have more open space? There's thousands and thousands of acres of parkland and state forests, and what are you complaining about? So I remember looking into it at the time, and it's substantial, but you're saying it's not in the right places? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I wish that we would be a little quicker about, once we acquire it, about opening it up to people. Those Jesuit lands were bought, 5-6 years ago? They're still not completely open to people. If you wanted to go to them, it's a little bit hard to figure out which ones. We just did a story, I don't remember which one it was, talking about the process of getting it open. So I do think that the state has done a pretty good job of preserving the important ecological properties. And part of this, I think, is because I covered some scandalous behavior, frankly, where they were buying land that wasn't under threat by development. And I don't know if it was necessarily because of the work I did at The Sun, but they've changed their policy quite a bit. And they're very focused on ecological and diversity and the important pieces by the water that are under threat of development. That's all good. But I think we can't just keep depending on the largesse of the state of Maryland. We need the counties to be able to step up, and we need them to be able to ask the developers to set aside some of these large, when you're developing a movie theater or a shopping center, just set aside some of that for open space and not.
You mean when you make a development rather than exchanging credits or things like that, tax credits or whatnot, for someplace else? You mean actually do it, make it part of the development?
Right. And Anne Arundel used to have a rule like this, where if you developed a shopping center and you went above your allowed acreage, you had to buy property to offset that. So I talked to one guy who developed the Village at Waugh Chapel down in Crofton, and the Anne Arundel County Council forced him to buy a farm down in South County just so he could have his shopping center.
Right.
And doesn't
that still go on?
Not as much as it did. And the other problem with it, I think the other problem, the other criticism of it, is you're offsetting your development, but the people in Waugh Chapel and Crofton aren't benefiting. The people in South County are benefiting. That's 45 minutes away. Mm-hmm. So you have to, I mean, we're going to be just living in these concrete blocks. And frankly, it's going to affect our moods and it's going to affect our environment. If we don't start thinking smartly about having some green space in our suburbs and in our cities.
Well, let's not assume that we understand the benefit of it, because you can be very specific about it. It reduces heat island effect that we see in the city and the suburbs around it, right? We talk a lot about stormwater remediation here. It's a controversy. It shouldn't be. It's a form of pollution we have to deal with. This is another way of dealing with it.
Yeah, I was really impressed with Pierce's Park down by Pier 6 at the Inner Harbor.
Oh,
and
they had a
big dedication and an opening for it. And to be honest, when I was there covering it, I thought, well, it's not that big a deal. This is this tiny little park, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I have been totally impressed with the way that park is used. People, even though it's just a small piece
of
green
space.
It's not
very big. These kids are playing there all the time.
Oh, they love it. They love it. I mean, they put the right things there. Kind of low impact playground kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Kids love it. And it's a stormwater retention area. It's extremely effective. There's all that impervious surface. It was really well thought out and really helpful. And it didn't take much out of the Inner Harbor to just carve out that little piece. And it's added so much.
So you're just saying you like to see more green integrated with development, especially in the suburban areas.
Yeah, I'd like to see more Pierce Park kind of things. Just a place where you could have lunch.
I mean, since we're going to talk about the legislature in a little while here and environmental issues, do we know, is program open space under threat? I guess it's always to some degree under threat. Or
yeah, I just heard that they cut $11 million from it, which is a pretty big chunk of change. So of course, more money will go in as transactions occur. But that's a lot, and I know every session the environmental community goes to the legislature and fights for more open space, either to hold the line or to get more. So I expect we'll see that. And it is actually, unlike many of these very controversial environmental issues, open space is actually gets a lot of bipartisan support. Everybody likes it.
Everybody likes it. Maybe it ought to be funded in a different way. Maybe the legislature ought to come up with more money for it rather than just relying on the transfer tax. That very, what did you say, 0.5%?
Yes.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here for Midday. Let's take a call for Rona Cabell while she's with us here, Midday on the Bay. Ed in Pasadena, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out that open space has more than one goal than securing land. It's also to provide recreation. So some of that money goes for baseball diamonds and parking lots and playgrounds.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Yeah, we pointed that out. I think that's very important.
Right. There's two pieces of it. There's the recreation, and then there's the what we think of open space. But you bring a good point up that it's a bit of a misnomer to put bleachers in Prince George's County and say open space.
Right.
I mean.
410-662-8780 is our phone number for Midday. You can reach us by email to midday@wypr.org. We'll take another break here. When we come back, we'll talk some more about program open space. In fact, I have some numbers I wanted to share about just how much open space we've preserved in the state. And then we'll move on to the legislature, the General Assembly, which convened yesterday with a very warm, bipartisan feeling. See the photograph of Larry Hogan and Anthony Brown. Very, you know, very warm, huggy, sort of Chris Christie, Jerry Jones kind of photograph there. we'll take a short break on Midday. We'll be right back. Yeah, just FYI, I looked up a story, a column I wrote. Gee, it's been almost 2 years. Boy, does time fly when you get to be my age. Anyway, this was 2 years ago. I thought I wrote this last April. It was April 2013. But nonetheless, the Department of Natural Resources said at the time that Maryland loses about 25,000 acres of agricultural and forest land to development each year. And the Department of Planning of the state of Maryland put out a report a few more years ago, 2010, tracking development activity across the state. The Department of Planning said that we can expect to lose approximately 560,000 acres to development by 2030. And they said that's the equivalent of the land area of Anne Arundel and Prince George's counties combined. You think, how is that possible? How can we even do that? If you do the math on that, you go by year, it comes out to about 28,000 acres per year. So the DNR was, in line, I guess, with the Department of Planning and their projections a few years ago. This is Midday on the Bay. Dan Roderick's here with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. Marcella has been holding to ask a question about another kind of island. We started off the show talking about barrier islands. Marcella, go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm a huge fan of your show.
Oh, thank
I've
you.
Been listening to your program for years and also enjoy your writing style as well.
Thank you, Marcella.
You're welcome. My question is, what is being done about the five islands of plastic currently in our oceans, which is a main contributor to the global warming problem? And I know a few years ago, the one in the Pacific was as large as Texas, and currently it's twice the size of Texas and growing. These plastic islands, we have water bottle islands, and I'm concerned that the plastic is not going away. It takes, 500,000 years to break down, and the fish are eating the plastic, and the sea life are getting tangled in it.
Yeah.
And it's not really talked about enough.
Mm-hmm. Marcella,
and I just wanted to approach that subject.
I don't have anything right here in front of me on that. Can you help us out with that, Rona?
Well, I guess a little bit. My colleague Laura Lutz wrote a story that is on the Bay Journal about a cruise that we were invited on in the Chesapeake Bay to look at microbeads of plastic, and some EPA officials and others went on this trip too, and they were quite astounded to see all these little microbeads of plastic. And there's going to be a ban, this is not a subject in which I am well versed, but to ban this kind of microbead in various personal care products, similar to what we did with the phosphorus ban in detergent. So, as I said, this is not
so
one
microbead meaning very tiny actual
yes.
bead of plastic.
Yes.
That comes out of some consumer products?
Yes, and it's the thing that gives your toothpaste the blue color. And Julie Lawson of Trash Free Maryland's got some information on it on her website, which is very well thought out.
So is Laura's piece about the microbeads?
Yes,
it's not about these big islands that are out in
right.
the ocean.
And in terms of big islands out in the ocean, I'm not sure. I think it's absolutely something we need to address, but it becomes very complicated because of the federal regulation of the ocean and where the jurisdiction stops and starts in the other countries. And it certainly does need to be addressed. I mean, it's heartbreaking to see these pictures of turtles and whales dying because of it.
And a lot of people cited this right here in Baltimore when the city council voted to ban plastic bags as a start to remove some of the plastic from the trash stream. And that issue is not over either. It's not finished.
Right. And it's been very effective in the D.C. area. I mean, they've seen a real decrease in plastic in the Potomac.
Alan in Stevenson in Baltimore County, thank you for calling. You're on Midday.
You're welcome. Can you hear me, Dan?
Sure. Go right ahead, Alan.
Okay. I'd like to talk about some of the abuses of program open space property. And one of the examples I'll cite is the Mace Chapel Park. Off of Fredonia Road in Baltimore County,
mm-hmm.
where the state and the county, the state allowed the county to take 20 acres of land and, that was used by the populations in the area, that was 10 of which were designated as program open space to build a school in an area where the demographic is mostly senior citizens. And they clear cut the entire property and have not replaced the POS land to the benefit, for the benefit of the local residents. I'd like to suggest that Baltimore County has an abysmal lack of pocket parks and local parks, particularly in the areas that are noted as community conservation areas. And those are defined as the older communities around the Beltway that have a total lack of pocket parks. And the county, while it touts, and you had the county executive on last week where he touts that he hasn't raised, the county hasn't raised taxes in years. Well, they've increased their taxes by having increased property bases that have yielded higher monies, but they haven't put back in the amenities that the population deserves. It's more important to them to put a school in which where the student population is not local so that they can open up the development and give building permits because they'll claim that they have adequate school facilities in the area.
I couldn't agree more with what you said about the pocket parks. Absolutely true. And in terms of the school, I think that, you know, I live in Baltimore County and I have a child who goes to a Baltimore County school. And they don't seem to be thinking too much about where they're putting these schools in terms of let's put a school where people can walk. You are absolutely right that Mays Chapel Elementary does not have a lot of kids that can walk to that school. I think they put the school there because they own the land. And from what I follow this just as a resident of the county, not as an environmental reporter, I believe that this has been litigated and that it was they lost and that the school is coming online and, you know, that the opponents tried very hard to make these points. But, when the school system owns the land and even if they own half the land, as you're saying in this case, it makes it really hard to argue with that.
Rona, about the legislature, it convened yesterday for 90 days, the Maryland General Assembly, and then Larry Hogan becomes governor next week, takes the oath of office. He has vowed to make his first fight overturning the, what do we call this, the chicken manure rules, the phosphorus management regulations,
yes,
that were put in place by the Department of Agriculture and the O'Malley administration in October, November. Hogan has told the poultry industry in Maryland that he's going to fight to overturn these, I guess because he thinks it's anti-business, it's going to hurt farmers. But anyway, I guess we're expecting to see that be the first fight of the Hogan administration. At least he's vowed to make it so.
Right.
First, some comment on that, then we'll talk about possible legislation that we might see this year.
One thing that I think is worth remembering is that this phosphorus management tool goes back at least until 2006. And so it isn't a new piece of legislation, a regulation. And what was originally going to happen in 2009, the federal government wanted to put in a national phosphorus standard that was based on a soil test. So they stick
for everybody, the whole
for
country?
For everybody. So they stick a probe in your soil and you either pass or you fail. And if you fail, no more phosphorus. So this was going to be what they were going to
do. Excuse me, you can't put phosphorus-based fertilizer anymore on your property.
Right. That would be the end of chicken manure as fertilizer in Maryland and also in Arkansas and Tennessee. And
what happened to that?
So the industry got extremely upset over this, which is to be expected. But what's maybe not to be expected is that soil scientists all over the country railed against this too. And their argument was, you can't do that to farmers because phosphorus is complicated, and a farm field in Illinois and a farm field in Maryland are not the same. And so you have steep slopes, you have close to the water, you have phosphorus traveling in the groundwater, you have all these different things. You can't just have a flat up or down test. You need an index. And the industry said, yes, you need an index. An index is much better than a flat test. So we're railing over this thing right now, which is actually a compromise. This was not the original.
So there's what we proposed or what O'Malley administration put in place, an index?
Yes, it's an index. We already had an index, and now we've refined the index. And the reason we refined the index is because scientists discovered that phosphorus travels very efficiently through these what they call subsurface pathways. So you've got the problem of the phosphorus running off the land when you put down the chicken manure, which is very rich in phosphorus.
Right.
And then you've got the second problem of it finding other ways to get into the waterway. And so they wanted to put together a rigorous scientific tool that took into account all these factors so that when farmers made decisions about where to put their fertilizer and how much, it would be a very informed decision. And that the difference between this tool and the last tool is that this one actually says no. So
this one actually says no, meaning if we find that you already your soil is saturated with phosphorus, you have to stop.
Right.
Whereas you can't apply chicken manure anymore.
Whereas the previous one had much more wiggle room. So if you were over the threshold on your soil test, you could offset that by putting in a buffer or by putting in a ditch management structure. And a lot of times they never came to see if that actually worked, but you were allowed to put that stuff in.
Larry Hogan doesn't need an act of the legislature to overturn this, even if he could get one.
No.
Can he use executive action to roll it back?
Well, it's going through the AELR, you know, the process of making the law. And what he can do is send it back and delay it and tweak it and go back and forth on it. And as it is, Dan, it wasn't supposed to be taking effect tomorrow. There's a couple years phase in and then, a couple years before it has to be done. So this is going to delay it. And what's important to know about this is we've got to make reductions in our nitrogen and phosphorus. And it's supposed to be equal across all sectors, agriculture, stormwater, sewage treatment. So if farmers don't have to reduce their phosphorus, the screws are going to be turned on us, the urban residents, further. And we're going to have to make further reductions with our sewage treatment, which is already pretty darn good. I mean, we've managed to get a lot of our nitrogen and phosphorus out of our poop, for lack of a better word. And at the same time, on the Eastern Shore, we're just putting that poop untreated on farms. So you see the problem.
Yeah, I see the problem. And suspicious of an incoming governor who I don't know how much time he spent thinking about this, being informed or advised about it. He just almost immediately upon hearing the news that this was put in place said, I'm against it. I don't like that it was done at the last minute or something. Now, you know, you can argue there. You say, well, why did O'Malley administration wait so long? It was delayed in part by the industry, right?
Right.
Over the years, this thing percolated for a couple of years, and it was finally put in place in the last months of the O'Malley administration. But that doesn't mean it's bad. So I don't like the jumping to a conclusion and making a promise already to the industry that he's going to overturn it without maybe fully understanding what the issues are. On the issue of chicken manure, because we learned so much about this past year, I don't want to spend too much more time
right.
on it, but it is a big problem. What about just trucking it away? What about burning it, which has been a proposed, more than a proposal? There's money available to establish a waste-to-energy plant somewhere over in the Eastern Shore or someplace in Maryland that would benefit farmers because they'd be able to get rid of more of it.
Well, one of the problems with the phosphorus management tool, and it could have been solved because there was this long delay, is we knew it was coming. We knew that it had to be implemented. But in the meantime, we didn't give farmers any solutions. So one day, a farmer had a haul of manure and he had no place to take it. And what we should have been doing in that time, in my opinion, is exactly the things that you said. We should have been working on manure to energy. We should have gotten a plant in place. We should have figured out a way to a manure storage area where we could temporarily put a sort of a collective manure and a way to maybe have trading credits or, you know, we had time to do that. We had time because at least since 2007, we've been talking about this.
Aren't there farmers in the Midwest someplace that could use some of this chicken manure for fertilizer?
The problem is that the cost of trucking it out because of the price of gas was so high that it wasn't worth
okay,
it.
Okay, well, that problem's kind of gone away for a little while.
Maybe.
I mean, what's wrong with spending a few more pennies per pound for a chicken, which is still a pretty good buy in the market, if that's going to be the result? Pay a little bit more, okay. Pay a little bit. You guys pay some more, and we'll pay some more, and we'll have a better situation here.
Well, you see where that went when the poultry tax was proposed, was it last session?
Five cents.
And
yeah.
O'Malley said, I'll veto it.
Yeah.
He didn't.
Good old O'Malley. Yeah. I'm running for president. I got to score some points in Des Moines.
He just
in Iowa. Okay. Fracking. Where are we on hydrofracturing for natural gas in Western Maryland?
Well, this is another proposal that Hogan criticized O'Malley for dropping on his way out, which were much a plan to allow fracking in Western Maryland, but under very strict guidelines. So we can expect, as we have pretty much every year since fracking has come up, to see a pretty liberal legislator from Montgomery County put in a bill to ban fracking. Every year they're put in, every year they go nowhere. I'm of the opinion that because fracking is being reduced in places with much less stringent regulation than what Maryland's going to have. I'm not so sure this is an issue that really riles a lot of people up, but I'm not so sure that it's that big an issue because the economics might just not be there for anybody to want to drill in Western Maryland.
Rona, you note here in your notes to me that there's an environmental justice bill we may see that will look at the cumulative effects when communities are proposed for an incinerator, when incinerators are being planned for communities. Barbara writes to us, Curtis Bay, she says,
yes,
is soon to be home to a new trash incinerator emitting up to 240 pounds of mercury and 1,000 pounds of lead annually. This is in addition to Curtis Bay being home to a coal terminal with coal ponds, a fertilizer plant, and a medical incinerator. How can the total maximum daily load goals be met with all of this being dumped into the bay? What, if anything, is happening to curtail this pollution? It's a good question. I'm going to hang on to that and take a look at it myself because I keep getting mail from people in that part of town, South Baltimore, Curtis Bay, about this incinerator.
Yeah, it's an important issue. And they have been dumped on in Curtis Bay, no question about it. And there is a fair question. Is it fair to put them through anything more?
On the need for parks, in our discussion a bit earlier about program open space, Suzanne writes to say that another reason we need more open space is that a lot of our existing open spaces are overused. I live near Patapsco State Park, and on a nice summer day, the park is so full that the gates are closed and they won't let anyone else in. Similarly, my family drove up to Rocks State Park, Harford County, near Jarrettsville last summer. When we got there, the parking lot was full, and we wouldn't have been able to go to the park if a nice local neighbor hadn't allowed us to park there. Once in the park, it was so crowded that we hardly got the nature experience we had hoped for. This was not a holiday weekend either. Apparently, that park is even more crowded on a weekend. Well, on one hand, you're glad to hear that people are using our state. We have some great state parks.
We do.
Some that are underused are, you know, like 2.5-3 hours away. They're not that convenient to get to. But
yeah,
for a weekend trip, they're fun. But she's right. The nearby parks, especially when you're near a metropolitan area, really do get used a lot.
They do, and that's why we need more of them.
the pocket parks, you'd like to see more pocket parks?
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I mean, I think it's nice to be able to have lunch outside downtown or, you know, be able to play soccer in a city without having to drive someplace.
I've said this. You know, Baltimore once had, 900,000, nearly a million people. It's at 627, 628 now. It's growing, going to grow a little bit. And there's all that vacant space, all that, you know, do we really need to have 900,000 people here? I don't think so. Maybe 700,000 would be nice. That still leaves you room for more green space. Of course, we already have a lot of nice green space in the city.
Yeah, the city
does not bad.
The city's doing a very good job, especially in comparison to the counties, I think.
Yeah, that's why we've also embraced the stormwater. I don't know if embrace is the word. I don't want to speak for everybody here because we're all paying the stormwater fee, and there's some businesses out there still griping about it. But the city is doing it.
Yeah, and particularly I've seen in lower-income neighborhoods, it's been very gratifying to see some of the things that you just talked about, you know, taking space and not rebuilding vacant houses and instead leaving them fallow so that they can be community gardens and public spaces.
You notice I didn't call it what we're not going to call it anymore.
Yes, thank you.
I'm not going to use the term anymore.
Good, thank you.
I've decided not to use it anymore. Anyway, Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal. It's chesapeakebayjournal.com if you want to read Rona's story about Cedar Island and see some of those photographs. And also, Rona has a piece about barrier islands in general that you wrote for Yale.
Yes.
A Yale University website on the environment.
Yes, it's called Yale Environment 360.
Okay, we'll take a look at that. And thank you again for being here, Rona. Rona joins us once a month for Midday on the Bay. Remember, you can get a free subscription to the Bay Journal at bayjournal.com. Have a great afternoon, everybody. See you, Rona.
Thank you so much. See you too.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.